From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
We take in consideration where we are opening and the people and, you know, how those people enjoy life. What would they like of the Italians? How do they eat? So we do take all of that in consideration.
That's chef, author, and television host Lidia Bastianich. She's a partner at Eataly, the Italian food megaplex that opened in Century City in November after months of anticipation from Angelinos. A brief note, a few weeks after we recorded this interview, Chef Mario Batali, who has a minority stake in Eataly, was accused of sexual harassment by several women. He has since stepped away from day-to-day operations, and Eataly has ceased carrying Batali's food products on its shelves. Hi, Lidia.
Hi, Evan. Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. Talk to us about how you and Oscar Farinetti, the founder of Eataly, originally met, and what was it about his project that so intrigued you?
Well, it was when he first opened Eataly in Torino. I was, I was always interested in what's happening new in Eataly because I was kind of the bringing Eataly to the States, and I wanted to know, was I missing anything? And so I heard about this Eataly opening. And what intrigued me was the size, that it encompassed fresh food, groceries, fish, meat, all fresh, butchers, cold cuts, and then dairy, cheeses, and then restaurants that serve those ingredients, and the school that taught the buyer, the customer, how to cook as well. So it had food 360 degrees all under one roof. And it was like an extravaganza or a piazza, big Italian piazza, all under one roof. So I decided that I would go and check it out. I went to Torino. There was also the Slow Food Congress that was going on, which I attended. And I made an appointment with Oscar, and I said, gee, can you show me around? Can you tell me what your thoughts are behind this? And he did. He showed me around. He was excited. I was just mesmerized by the whole thing. And it was full. People were shopping in Eataly, and I was, really taken by it. Eventually, he asked me to, would I come back and would I do an event? And I did. I went back and I did two separate events, you know, just to see what is the mechanics, how are the people receiving this? And the two events went beautifully. The wonderful part, and which really intrigued me and interested me, was that Oscar paired with Slow Food, and the products were mostly products from this Slow Food artisans, food artisans. So it was the best that Eataly had to offer. After we had the event, we had lunch and whatever, and he said, you know, Lidia, I think that this concept would go great in America, in New York. Would you be interested in partnering? I said, certainly, it's a great concept. Let me go back. Let me talk to my partners, my boys, which was, Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich, my son. They loved the idea. And so we went into it. This is a concept that we would join in with Oscar Farinetti and Eataly in Eataly and extend it into the States. We became the partners of the Americas, North and South America. We are not partners in the Italian ones, but we certainly have enough territory here to kind of spread out. And as you know, our latest one was in Los Angeles a month ago.
Before you opened in LA, what other cities did Eataly open in?
New York was the first one, and that's on 23rd Street and 5th Avenue. Then we opened in São Paulo. We went down even to São Paulo, Chicago then. Chicago was very exciting, was big. From Chicago, we went downtown again to New York in the World Trade Center, Boston, and now L.A.
How large is the marketplace, and do you have an idea of how many products are being sold?
The place itself in L.A. is 67,000 square feet, and it spreads through three floors. And there's more than 10,000 different products that we sell there. We have four restaurants there, nine eateries, two cafes, two bars, and we have five different retail departments and 5 fresh production counters where we literally produce product like mozzarella or yogurt or so on.
Two of the coffee bars that you have are the traditional Italian stand-up bars. Are people doing that? Are they coming in, ordering a cafe, and then just powering it back and leaving?
Absolutely. You know, I think that Americans like to linger a little bit more if they're going to go have a coffee. So we do have a cannoli stand right next to that. We do have a little tempting goodies and sweets that they can have with their coffee. And in the morning, we have this great spread of breakfast, you know, kind of panino breakfast with the cold cuts or fried eggs or whatever in a croissant or, you know. So cafe, as in Italy, as the bar is known. We have 2. One is right downstairs and one is more upstairs within, so that if they're eating at the restaurants, they can have a cafe, finish with their coffee upstairs. Or otherwise, if they're coming in just for a cannoli and coffee or meet a friend like one would do in Italy, they have downstairs.
One of the products that I found most intriguing was this type of piadine, this type of bread made by a batter that was squirted onto a terracotta tile. Could you talk a bit about those?
The panigacci.
Yeah.
Panigacci, it was born in Potenzana, a small town in Tuscany. And it's a flatbread. You know, now most cultures had some form of flatbreads. But this is rather very simple and unique on how it was baked. The ingredients is water, wheat flour, and salt. The wheat flour could be white. It could be a little bit on the whole wheat, which the way I like it. And then this mixture, this almost like a pancake mixture, but not as porous, is poured on this hot terracotta tiles, plates sort of, and they're stacked on top of each other, and the heat of these terracotta tiles cook. This flatbread gets caught between the 2 tiles. It gets cooked, and once it's finished, it's a delicious flatbread, which we fill. It could be filled with savory options or even sweet. It could be just turned into a sweet. Add some honey, some nuts, fruits, jams, and all of that. A simple kind of eating is, you know, I recall when I was young, you know, grandma made the bread, the hot bread, and you can turn it into certainly a savory sandwich, or you can spread on top some of ricotta, some honey, and you had a dessert.
Or maybe even some Nutella.
You got it.
Now, the teaching component that's in LA is this really, like, beautifully built out school. What are some of the classes that students are going to be able to experience, and will you be teaching some of them?
I will. I will be coming over and teaching. We are just putting in program the timing and when. But, you know, we will open our schools like we do most of our schools to all ages. We look forward to having young children, especially what works well for us here in New York City and even downtown is the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, during the day for the young ages. And then, of course, it'll go from pasta making to risotto to techniques to understanding product to tasting products to creating, you know, a dinner altogether, the pairing of food and wine. So it's endless, you know, the making of gnocchi. And we usually respond to what the needs are. And the needs, you know, mostly have been a lot about making pasta, that is fresh dough pasta, gnocchis, and also dishes with dry pasta, you know, finishing dishes with dry pasta is also very popular. What the beauty of that is that, you know, there'll be an opportunity to have some hands-on. And we have an Italian chef from the Napoli area. He's wonderful and very enthusiastic. And he will take a class, let's say, through an appetizer, a main course, and a dessert. And in that case, he will demonstrate and make enough for everybody. And all the students will have the recipe, will have an opportunity to look through the cameras and that we have the screens and listen, ask questions, and then they get to eat it. So at the end of the class, they had like a little dinner, a full dinner, never mind a little dinner, you know, an appetizer, whether it's a salad, whether it's, you know, whether we make shrimps or clams, and then a main course, whether it's chicken or fish and a vegetable, usually a complete meal, and then a dessert. And wine, we usually match wine. So we have also the wine that we choose. Why? We have a sommelier talk about the wine so that the students get to listen, get to see, get to taste, get to talk to a sommelier about the wine and how to pair the wine and the food, and ultimately get to taste all of that. So when they're finished, they had a lesson, they had an opportunity to ask questions, and also they had a meal.
If you're not busy enough, you also have another cookbook out that you wrote with your daughter, Lydia's Celebrate Like an Italian. Leave us with something for this time of year.
Yes, yes. It came out in October. And again, that's a response to, you know, the viewers asking me, Lydia, you got to tell us, you got to help us out. How are we going to do a party? And so it's in there. There's 220 really good, simple, straightforward recipes. And then within the book, I give the techniques, the recipe, but also I tell them how to organize a party. For example, in the beginning, I have 20 drink recipes. One of them, for example, is an Italian in Manhattan. So it's my take on the Manhattan. And yes, you have the rye and the sweet vermouth, but at the end, I put the bitters, some Italian bitters. That makes it an Italian Manhattan. And what I suggest is, you know, because usually people fret over giving a party. I said, you're in control. It's your party, and you can make it the way you want it, and especially for drinks. Just give them this one drink. You put them on the table, put all the accoutrements, the whiskey and the ice, give them the recipe and let them enjoy that one drink. Don't worry about who likes Tanqueray, who likes Bifida, who likes, you know, 20, 30 bottles, just one. And then, of course, you have some red wine, some white wine. So I tell them how to take it in their hand and make their guest be a participant and enjoy it.
Lydia Bastianich is a partner at Eataly, the Italian food emporium opened in Century City last November. Coming up, we talk sexual harassment with a Toronto restaurateur who's calling out her industry peers. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
And it also makes it difficult to understand, like, what maybe happened between two people who ended up being the last two people at the bar one night, and one of them's a manager and one of them's not, and things get a little bit strange. And maybe if you're the person who has less power in that situation, you don't really know how to interpret it.
That's Toronto restaurateur and author Jen Ag. Jen's been incredibly vocal about gender inequality and sexual harassment in her industry. She recently published a memoir titled I Hear She's a Real Bitch. We wanted to speak with her about her experience and bro culture. Hi there.
Hi, I feel like we've done this before.
Yeah, over and over again. Although I have to say, I was reading an essay written by San Francisco chef Ricky Nakano, who wrote a piece for Chef's Feed. He calls out his fellow bros, and the very last sentence I thought was pretty great. He says, what we need to do is get to a place where doing blow and pretending a baguette is a d- isn't cool. Guys, come on. I feel like he's the first one who's just laid it out there.
Well, I beg to differ. I feel like I've been saying that stuff for a really long time.
No, I mean of the guys.
I think for me, sometimes it is a little bit difficult to see, even though, of course, I want men speaking out like that. Absolutely, that's what I want. but to see them sort of not acknowledge the work that I've been doing for my entire career is kind of disheartening sometimes. I want to see it. It's what I want. And I don't want to be like bitter about how it happens, but it's hard. You know, you pee on a corner for a long time. It's your corner. And then someone's like, hey, I'm going to pee on this corner too. And you're like, totally, there's room for both of us to pee. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. One of the things that has always fascinated me about you is that you don't work in a kitchen. You're an owner and you've come up through the front of the house. A place that when I was in the kitchen and when I was running a business always intimidated the hell out of me because I was one of those people who found it really hard to hang in the social right. way of going out to drink or drug or whatever after work, which I think a lot of people don't understand how much a part of team building that ends up being.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, first of all, in terms of not coming up in a kitchen, I think that that's something I want to address just before I get to the other prong of this. And I think a lot of women will say, you know, you're not a cook. Why are you speaking for women cooks? And I don't think that's what I'm trying to do. I'm really just trying to talk for people in the restaurant business. I know that's not what you asked me, but sometimes I think it's just a worthwhile point to make. In terms of bonding and team building, part of what makes the lines blur, along with the sort of militaristic hierarchical structure that exists in restaurants, where, you know, if somebody's giving you an order, sometimes it can be hard to tell if they're just being your boss or if they're being inappropriate. And I think because you get so used to that kind of vibe, it can be a little bit confusing. So, you know, if somebody's sort of sliding into abuse, you maybe as a young cook don't even realize that that's what's happening because there's just that sort of like call and response that exists in a kitchen in the first place. And then if you add buckets of beer and drugs, although I think it's not really the way quite so intense the way it used to be, or at least that's my experience, or maybe I'm just getting older. But if you add in all of that other stuff and the bonding that happens after hours, it really does like create eraser blurred lines in a real way that's different from other industries where wine isn't, you know, a backbone of those other industries.
Yeah, it makes it exceedingly difficult.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm sure. In your essay for The New Yorker, you wrote, which I love this sentence so much, the world of restaurants is a rusty old cargo ship, hot, loud, slow to change course, which is a strong irony, considering how trend-based food culture is.
Right. I do think that it's a really strange, ironic thing. I mean, I think some of that can be explained by some people in this business kind of buying culture and buying design. Do you know what I mean by that?
Why don't you go ahead and explain?
If you have, say, a chef-owner concept or front-of-house and back-of-house partnership, maybe somebody brings just strictly front-of-house skill and somebody else brings strictly, you know, the ability to cook and everything else within that needs to happen to make that a cultural hub is purchased.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And I've been thinking so much about this lately, and I don't think we talk about it nearly enough in the restaurant business because it's sort of, you can create the perception of cool without actually being cool. And I mean, that already sounds really lame when you start using words like cool like that. But I think that there are true visionaries, artists, people in front and back of house, but like the vast majority of people in this business are craftspeople. And there obviously there are times on a plate where it becomes artistry and that's really elevated. But all of the other things that make a restaurant a place that people want to be, want to gather, There's a real art to that. And if you start buying that, for lack of a better way to put it, by hiring people that make playlists for you, by hiring designers to create a vision for you, by, you know, having somebody pick the art you hang, then really it does start to look like something that isn't maybe actually all that cool, but that the dining public perceives as cool.
I think it's really interesting, especially in light of the money pouring into the restaurant business right now.
Yes.
From investors who expect to get that money out.
It's always economic. I was just talking about this earlier today, about the kind of people that are investing in restaurants. And I mean, I think it's without real statistics to support this, I can feel comfortable saying the vast majority are white men. I'm in a very fortunate position that I've bankrolled all of my own restaurants because I started small and I just kept reinvesting my money in the business. And it took a long time for me to make money as a result of that. But I also don't have anyone to answer to, which is a very, very rare and fortunate place to be in this business. The kinds of the nightclub companies that back restaurants or tech companies, I don't know who's backing restaurants right now. Who are they going to want to hire? Are they going to want to hire somebody who's like them, who's kind of a bro, who maybe has a profile because the media pays so much more attention to bro chefs than they do to other types of chefs? How do we get out of that? Give women more attention, make them more desirable to be backed. I mean, it's the whole thing's so broken.
For those who didn't do a real careful reading of Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, yeah, a lot of the book really is about how not to do what he did. But your memoir is perhaps an unintentional sort of counterpoint.
Yeah, definitely unintentional, but I've heard that before.
How did you navigate your way around the business when you first started out?
Kind of like a drunk baby giraffe, I think, on really unsure footing in lots of ways, but with like extraordinary confidence. So, you know, learning a lot of things the hard way, feeling reliant on people at certain points in my career where, you know, I had a partnership that maybe wasn't, well, not maybe, it wasn't my ideal partnership, and feeling extraordinarily reliant on that person and thinking that if I didn't have that person, I wouldn't be able to succeed, which of course wasn't the case. But gaining the confidence that I have now took a lot of hard lessons. So I think, you know, I don't know that there's a different way I could have gotten to this place, if that's sort of what you meant.
So you weren't a take no prisoners standing up for yourself and the women around you when you first started?
Oh, I was. No, I definitely was. But I think I was a little like, now I don't give a shit. I'll say whatever I'm thinking at most times. So, I mean, I was maybe a little more careful, but no, my personality hasn't changed that much. I just felt a little more muzzled, maybe.
Let's talk for a minute about the different roles that women are expected to play in the front and the back of the house. The front of the house, given the tip structure of most restaurants today, that we still rely on the customer to pay the salary of a server, leads to some pretty muddy waters for women. And then in the kitchen, the women are supposed to just pretend like they're men.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, in my restaurants, we don't do it the same way most restaurants do. We spread the tips more evenly, and the cooks do a lot of front of house stuff. So in terms of like food running, so it's a little bit different, and it actually has led to a way better relationship between front and back, which I think is a much happier room to be in for everyone, including diners. But the idea that we're the same is troubling to me, that men and women are the same is troubling to me, that we can achieve the same things, of course. But at the same time, you know, I think about all the women in kitchens who I've talked to over the years who've looked me straight in the eye and with all sincerity have said, I've never really noticed a problem. Like, it's always been fine. And all I can think is internalized misogyny. Like, how can you not see inside yourself and understand that you've maybe had to navigate kitchens in a far different way than men just to get ahead or just for self-protection? And I mean, that might not be true for every single woman. Maybe some women just naturally had those character traits. And it is extremely complicated, but I think it's fair to say that, yeah, in the front of house, women are meant to be sort of matriarchal and caregivers and caretakers and smile. I tell a story in the book.
I love
about,
that story.
It's really a thing. I mean, if I'm hosting, I just have to be so conscious of having my face be its most pleasant self at all times. Whereas if men who I've worked with for years are doing the same job, they just have to say the words politely. They don't have to exude warmth, and people won't be put off by that. And so that's a really strange thing to navigate, because as a business owner, I don't want to be the kind of person that's like, smile. But at the same time, I also want everyone in the room to be warm. So what my decision has been as a boss is to just say the same thing to men that I say to women working for me, which is, you know, please like remember to smile at people and to be friendly and all of that stuff that, you know, I don't want to hear maybe as a woman.
You do put in FaceTime at your restaurants.
Absolutely. Almost all the time.
In just the day-to-day being there, what tips would you have for other business people to foster a sense of respect and correctness?
So if you'll let me, I just want to make a point here because one's going to lead into the other, which is that I think we're going to see a lot of these letters, open letters, like we saw recently from Tom Colicchio. And that's great. There was a lot of good things in it. The tone was correct or whatever. you know, if I'm being judgy, like it hit the right notes. I do think that there could be more of a self-reflective kind of spotlight, Sean, in particular, the Renee Redzepi essay from a couple years ago. I think that there's more complicity than I lost my temper, I yelled at someone once. And I think that men who are running kitchens who want to release statements like that really need to examine, like, was that really how you were running your kitchen? You lost your temper, you got a little excited one time, or is it like so much worse than that? And I think it's hard. It makes them uncomfortable. And of course, they don't want to talk about that. But putting out a letter like that and then saying, you know, on Twitter, there is no bro culture in my kitchens, that's something I wouldn't even say. And I work really hard. I'm actively combating the idea of bro culture, and I'm doing it in the rooms every day. And I still wouldn't say that because I think, you know, you can't be in every corner in every second. Like maybe some stuff happens that I don't know about. I try to know about it. And I'm available to my staff if they have issues. But it's the kind of statement that was just sort of setting itself up for exactly what happened, which is a woman who works for him responded on Twitter and said, you might think this is what's happening, but, you know, it's not. I've complained twice. I work in your LA restaurant and I've complained about terrible treatment twice. I'm paraphrasing. In the last 12 months and nothing's happened. And to his credit, you know, he agreed to meet her. And I certainly hope that they came to some kind of resolution. But my point is that although these letters are helpful and necessary, and I can't believe more male chefs aren't doing it. I think so far in this last little time, it's been Colicchio, Daniel Patterson, and Richie Nakano. Bourdain, I mean, I don't sort of put him in that category. I think he's in a different category than a person running restaurants, but he's certainly made really good moves, especially in terms of like looking at how he contributed to this and being really honest about it, which I think is a very difficult thing to do. So I really do applaud that he's doing that. So anyway, I'm shocked that more people aren't speaking out, but at the same time, it's not enough to just to write that piece. And I think that speaks to what Richie's saying in his piece. We have to actually take action. What does that mean? Which is now getting to the question you asked me. Oh my God, I did it. Full circle. I think that A, it's FaceTime. It's actually being there. It's being in the room and not just popping by. At least once a week, I'm at the Hoof in the afternoon. And a few other days a week, I'm at Grey Gardens because it's the newest one. The Hoof's, you know, the Hoof's almost a decade old. And Roland spends a lot of time at Rum and Agricole. And, you know, I check in cocktail bars. So I just make the time to be there. I'm at Grey Gardens during service. I'm watching the room. And it absolutely makes a difference when I'm there. I might have the best managers in the country. And I believe that I do. But it's going to be a little bit different when I'm there. People are going to be a little bit more aware maybe of the jobs that they're doing, of how they're treating the people around them. I don't know what to say to people that sort of have empires and 12 restaurants and they're in far-flung places. I mean, yes, of course, there can be management that you trust. But I don't know. It's a top-down thing. And if you have cultivated a bro culture in your restaurant, you know that you've done that. It's going to take a lot of weeding out to change that.
That's Jen Ag. We've been talking about harassment and inequality in the restaurant industry, as well as her book, I Hear She's a Real Bitch. Coming up, a visit with Jonathan Gold, who says a fast casual restaurant in Santa Monica might serve the best spaghetti alla matriciana in the city. Can that be true? Stay tuned to find out.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Now a visit with resident food critic Jonathan Gold. He's here to tell us about a fast casual restaurant that surprised him. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
Where are we going today?
We're going to downtown Santa Monica.
How unusual.
I know, right? This is more or less a fast food restaurant, fast casual restaurant called Uovo.
Uovo meaning egg in Italian.
Right.
Does that mean it's a fresh pasta restaurant?
That's all they sell, is fresh pasta.
And are they making the fresh pasta there on premises?
No, they have a plant, a kitchen, or something in Bologna. I guess if you're going to have somebody make fresh pasta for you, it might as well be in Bologna. the guys behind the restaurant, I guess, were trying to bring in those Italian eggs, you know, the ones with those super bright orange yolks, and found that they were impossible to import. But they could import the pasta made with them.
All they have to do is find a farmer to get the additive to the chicken feed that will make those eggs be that exact color.
You and I know it's marigold petals.
it's a bit more complicated than that, but yes. So the expectation of fresh pasta that is flown in from Bologna means it should be pretty great, was it?
I'm almost ashamed to admit it, but yeah, it was.
Why do you feel so much shame liking this place?
Because the pasta's flown in from Bologna. You know, the story behind pasta is that you have somebody in the kitchen doing it behind the wall. You know, somebody's grandmother who's been doing it for the last 40 years. And I guess you have to let the dough rest, so it might as well rest in the hold of a 737. I don't know.
So let's hope that the rest of the ingredients don't have quite that carbon footprint.
Big carbon footprint. I know you and I talk a lot about spaghetti a la matriciana. It's one of my favorite things to cook and eat. It's one of your favorite things.
Yep.
You know, you talk to Italians about it, and they will go on for hours. They will want to clap you in irons for the idea of using onions, right?
Some of them.
And some of them cheerfully use onions.
So are you telling me they're making amatriciana with fresh pasta?
They are. They're using tonnarelli, which is basically a fresh spaghetti. It's more or less the same as spaghetti alla chitarra, right?
Yeah, it's square spaghetti.
Yeah. I think that's permissible almost anywhere, even Lazio, right? But it works. It's not super firm, but it's like it has a bounciness. It has a nice bite to it. The flavor is good. I'd like to go on about how you can taste the egg, but you can't taste the egg under the sauce. But it's lightly sauced. They do this thing browning the guanciale that I can't quite figure out. They cut it in lozenges the way that you see sometimes with pancetta, but it's hard to do with guanciale, which is a cheek and is much more irregular. They do that, and they manage to get it so it's browned and crisp, but really sort of molten inside.
The deep fryer?
I don't think so, though, because the fat that renders out is more important to the dish than the meat itself. My guess was a plancia, but I don't know.
Interesting. So the pasta that you had there, that sort of sets off the egginess of this fresh pasta the best?
I'd say probably the classic, you know, bolognese sauce would be the closest to that. There's green lasagna that's sort of crusty and tomatoey and bechamel-y and not the sort of over-the-top version meaty that you get sometime. They do decent tortellini, as you would expect from pasta made in Bologna, which are small. They're the right size. They're not teeny, teeny, but they're small. There's stuff with cured meats as well as other things.
Are they serving it in brodo or are they serving it sauced?
They serve it in brodo, and they also serve a version in Parmesan cream.
Ooh, how nice and old-fashioned.
Very old-fashioned.
Or it's not old-fashioned in Northern Italy, just here in California.
It's not the thing that you probably ever make for yourself. And I probably should also mention the tonnarelli with cacio e pepe. They use pecorino romano, as they should. It's not blasted with pepper, but there's pepper there. And the emulsion is nice. It's super salty, but pecorino romano is a super salty cheese, and it just means essentially that they're using enough of it.
What is the price point of this fast casual imported pasta?
The pastas range from $14 to $16. There's no first courses. You can get a vegetable if you want, you know, broccoli or string beans cooked in the oven. And from the time you sit down to the time you leave is about 25 minutes.
This reminds me of places in Italy that are sometimes called pasta pronto.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
No coffee, no dessert. You're kicked out onto the street. Luckily, you're a block from the Santa Monica Promenade, where there's an espresso bar every 6 feet.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That's Jonathan Gold on Uovo in Santa Monica. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. Next up, we turn to Laura Avery, who has the scoop at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Happy to be talking today to two chefs, Heather Sperling and Emily Pfeiffer, who are co-owners of Botanica Restaurant in Silver Lake, just opened in May of this year. So let's talk about the restaurant. So Botanica suggests, well, flowers and plants, and talk a little bit about the food. And what are you shopping for today?
Sure. So Botanica is definitely about vegetables in a big way. Vegetables are the star. It's not a vegetarian restaurant. We have really beautiful wild Pacific seafood. We have sustainably raised meats. But vegetables are what really make us most excited and make our hearts sing. So today we're here picking up a lot of everything. Persimmons, Japanese sweet potatoes, broccolini, spigarello, and lots of beautiful cauliflower.
Oh boy, and we can talk about cauliflower now. It's kind of waiting. We have the multicolor cauliflower, so let's describe it and then tell me the dish.
There is an extreme difference between buying cauliflower from the farmer's market than buying from the grocery store. I remember the first time I bought a cauliflower from a farmer's market, and I think that I might have gasped because it had a flavor. It was nutty and it was sweet almost, and it was just so gorgeous, and you could eat it raw and not be turned off by it. So that's what we're here shopping for today.
So right now it seems like we've got all the fall cauliflower varieties. We've got the salmon colored one, we got the purple one, the white one, and then that wonderful Romanesco. So what kind of cauliflower are we talking about here?
Well, the multicolored cauliflower, white, green, orange, purple, is so gorgeous. It's like Emily was saying, it's sweet, it's nutty, you can use it raw, you can use it cooked. So there are two ways that we're really excited to use it. Right now we're searing a ton of it at the restaurant and putting it on top of Romesco, which is a roasted red pepper, toasted almond spread. But one of the things that we're gonna put on the menu soon is it's a sort of braised cauliflower. It's a high heat braise where we roast the cauliflower either whole with the core hollowed out to help it cook more evenly or halved. And we roast it in this really, really luscious braising liquid of pimenton, Spanish smoked paprika, citrus, tons of garlic, white wine, and olive oil. And so you roast it in a pan with most of it exposed, but then this really lovely braising liquid at the bottom. You baste it regularly, and it develops this gorgeous, luscious crust, and then the pan juices cook down and become almost jammy. And that we love to serve with some California wild rice, toasted almonds, currants, a really bright, crunchy wild rice salad, because the nuttiness and the sweetness of that plays off of the roasted cauliflower so beautifully. And you have a little bit of texture on the outside from roasting at a high temp, and then it's soft and luscious and creamy on the inside. And it's just, it's a beautiful dish. We're really excited to get it on the menu. So we love it that way, but we're pretty obsessed with it raw too.
Yeah, so I would say that most of the people who are cooking cauliflower are just roasting it or just eating raw florets. But for all of you with mandolins out there, if you shave a cauliflower on a mandolin, you get the gorgeous sections of the vegetable, and they look beautiful served in a salad. You really get that intense sweetness and crunchiness and that beautiful texture when you're serving it raw. So all it really takes is some toasted nuts, a couple of varieties of herbs, maybe a fruit. We've done apple, toasted walnut, basil, lemon juice, olive oil, pecorino. Sea salt, pecorino, and it makes just a lovely, simple salad that you can throw together really, really easily.
And this is the one time when you're actually eating the stem because it's part of that whole slice.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, you can roast the stem too. It's actually something that I was thinking about when Heather was talking.
Talk about the leaves.
Oh, the leaves.
The leaves.
The leaves. The stems and the leaves.
Get to it.
Well, you can roast the leaves and the stem of a cauliflower if you just remove them from the florets and kind of smother them in olive oil and sea salt and roast them at a high heat. They turn super crispy at the edges, and then you can just knife and fork them and throw them in a salad or served on any kind of platter.
Or just roast them off while you're doing whatever else you're doing with your cauliflower and eat them as a snack. They're so beautiful. It really, the leaves of the cauliflower are a gift that should not be ignored. It's so delicious.
That was chef co-owners Heather Sperling and Emily Pfeiffer from Botanica in Silver Lake, clearly celebrating the vegetables of California. I'm talking now with John Herr of Herr Family Farm, which is located in Fresno. He's one of our many Hmong farmers who come into all of the Santa Monica markets. And you have quite the display. You've got the orange cauliflower, the purple cauliflower, and the white cauliflower on your table. Did you start out just growing one and then kind of change as the customers started giving you?
Yeah, we started out with the white, and then as customers and chefs prefer the colored ones, we just start growing it.
Okay, and then when do you have to plant it, and how long is it in the ground?
Start off in August, September, and then we do like three different batches, August, September, and then every month we just start off with a different batch. For us, it's all by hand. Yeah. We don't have a transplanter, so it's a lot of work.
Okay, so you have three successive plantings, so how much longer will you have
September
this?
Until February. It should be until like spring, until everything flowers up, then these will flower up with everything.
Okay, so the orange and the purple and the white, is there any difference in the flavor?
If you roast them all up, it's gonna be very similar. Like just the texture, purple's gonna be a little softer compared to the others, but it's very similar.
And it looks like the white out of all of them seems like it's maybe opening up a little more. Was that planted sooner or what?
Yeah, well, the white, they're always ready first, so.
They just grow faster?
Yep, they just grow a lot faster than the other ones. Probably like 2 weeks sooner. We can like 2 weeks sooner than like the other.
All right. Well, they look like you're in full bloom right now.
Yeah,
and
right now is the prime season right now for us for broccoli, cauliflower.
Yeah, winter, hardy winter greens. Yeah. John, I know there's a lot of Hmong farmers up in the Fresno area. How did your family wind up here and how did you guys start farming?
Well, the war brought my parents over here to the United States. And then my dad and my mom, they used to pick grapes and then they weren't making much. So one of my uncles were doing the Santa Barbara market, and then he injured himself. So he asked my dad to take over. So my dad took over, and then we just grew from there.
Did he teach your dad how to farm?
Well, my parents, they farmed in the homeland. So so they just kind of winged it, did whatever.
Are they growing anything here that they used to grow over there?
Like the Thai onions, Hmong pumpkins, mustard greens.
How about these fabulous sweet potatoes?
They grew mainly yams. Yeah. That's about it. But everything, we kind of just trial and error everything.
All right. Well, this looks gorgeous. Your table looks great. And you come to the Wednesday market on alternating weeks. Yes. Where else can we find you down here in L.A.?
Venice on Fridays.
Every Friday. All right, John. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. You guys have a good one.
That was John Herr. He's the farmer from Herr Family Farm. He's located up in Fresno. And right now we're in full cauliflower season. We got orange cauliflower, purple cauliflower, white cauliflower, and it'll be in all the way through late spring. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
After the break, a Portland chef and cookbook author who's bringing her family's food traditions from motherland to table.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Immigrant food is personal and reflective of a snapshot of time and of history. Bonnie Fremkin-Morales is a child of Jewish Belarusian immigrants from the Soviet Union. She cooks food that is at once familiar and new at her Portland restaurant, Kachka, that she runs with her husband, Israel.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so happy for you to be here. I haven't had the pleasure yet of going to Kachka, but it will be the first place I go the next time I go to Portland.
Well, please let us know. We'd love that.
What is the meaning of Kachka to your family?
Well, Kachka is a word. It means duck. But in my family, it has to do with survival and tenacity. And my grandmother, during World War II, she was in a ghetto. It was clear they were digging a hole. Things were getting bad. She tried to get her whole family to escape with her. And they said, you know, we're weak and old and you're young. Just go ahead. So she did. She left in the middle of the night. The next morning, everyone was shot. So she traveled through the forests in October, and basically dead winter in Russia at that time, or Belarus, traveling towards Russia. and just fighting for her life. She buried her infant along the way. She was stopped by a town warden, starosta, who thought something's fishy about you. I think you're Jewish and you're lying to me. So he questioned her and pushed her, and she said, no, I'm just a Ukrainian peasant traveling through. And he insisted, he said, if you're Ukrainian, then how do you say duck in Ukrainian? It's utka in Russian. So how do you say utka in Ukrainian? And she hoped and that it was the same in her native Belarusian and Yiddish. Some words do overlap. Not all of them do, obviously. So that's all she could go on. So she, you know, sort of crossed her fingers and said, Kachka. And it happened to be one of those words that did overlap. And he let her go. And it's not the one moment that defined everything. I mean, it was a war that a lot of luck, you know, a lot of luck throughout my family. And so, but that one, for whatever reason, when I was a little girl, when my dad would tell stories of my family, that one always stuck out. So in trying to think of a name to represent my family and what we were trying to achieve at the restaurant, Kachka just came to me.
You have in giant bold letters in the foreword of your book, this is not a Russian cookbook. So could you talk a little bit about that fluidity and overlap of Jewishness, Belarusianness, and Russianness?
Absolutely. It's so complicated. It's hard. When you say the word Russian, that's a moving target. What Russia is now is not what Russia was when my parents immigrated. And I mean, it gets even more complicated the more time you go, but that goes by. But when my parents immigrated, it was the Soviet Union, and that's, you know, 15 republics, and there's a lot going on. You have everything, you know, from Georgia and Uzbekistan overlapping and cross-pollinating with the Baltics and with Jewish culture as well. And so when somebody says that they're Russian today versus when they say that they're Russian, you know, in 1975, let's say, that means very different geographic borders and therefore the food that comes with it as well.
So when your mother was growing up, when your parents were growing up there, was there a division of Belarusian and Soviet food in their houses?
Not so much a division between probably Belarusian and Soviet as much as Jewish and Soviet, or a lot of sort of the details of any particular republic was muddied. There were some campaigns on the part of Stalin at various times to intentionally muddy that. You can see some evidence of that in, there's a cookbook that was published multiple times during the Soviet Union that, depending on sort of the political climate, they either chose to remove the republic that was associated with the cuisine or highlight it. And so further on, you see a lot more of that muddying. So you don't see something, you know, called, let's say, harcho. They just called it a beef stew. So defining, you know, one of the republics like Belarus and their cuisine and what the items are that come from there didn't come up a lot because they were trying to, you know, make it all one big country. But the Jewish population sort of had their own way of doing things. And so even within, let's say, cabbage rolls, something that I feel like everybody from that region makes a version of, my mother's version versus their neighbors have differences, and you see those by whether they're Jewish or not, often more than the fact that they're both from Belarus.
So would the difference be pork and non-pork, or would it be savory versus sweet and sour?
Yeah, it's more the flavor profile, because everybody used pork, even if you were Jewish. It's just you had to if you were going to eat meat. It was what was available. I mean, my mother's father was a kosher butcher in town, so she was lucky. She had access to calves and cows, but most people used pork in my parents' family, my father's family, for example. But it was more sweet and sour in the Jewish version, and very, very saucy and braisy. And the more traditional Belarusian way was a little bit of a leaner sauce, paler style. And obviously, yes, pork all the way.
Okay, so now let's talk about you in particular. So you are a classically trained chef. You cooked in a lot of really great houses in New York and also in Chicago. I would imagine growing up, like many kids, you kind of wanted to push your, quote, your people's food away in your quest to achieve a certain level of technical expertise in your field. What happened that you decided to embrace this, and this was the food that you created with Kachka?
You know, I met my husband at the time we were working together at a restaurant in Chicago. And we were dating, and you take your boyfriend home to meet the parents, that whole thing. Whenever I'd have friends or a boyfriend or whatever over to my parents' house, I always had this caveat. Come full, you know, make sure that you are fully fed and that you don't try anything too weird, sort of big asterisk to coming over. And he walked away from the first time he had dinner at my parents' house with just, like, wide eyes and, you know, was amazed and said that it was some of the best food he had ever eaten and wanted more of it, couldn't get enough. And so he started going to my parents' house for dinner more and more, obviously. And my mom started to get excited, too. She started making things that she hadn't made in a while. So we all kind of started exploring this food again together. And so while we were dating, we just would talk a lot about the food because he sort of changed the way I thought about it. And at some point, I was like, wait, you know, this food's not broken. You know, I had this feeling like it was just broken. You know, French food could maybe fix it or something like that. But he totally kind of changed that to being like, it is its own thing and you should be proud of it. And it deserves a place at the table.
It's so interesting because when you opened Kachka, there were really, were there any other restaurants doing a sort of modern take on this kind of food?
I don't think so. Maybe there is out there, but I haven't found it.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so either. And one of the things that I find fascinating is about how you choose to present Kachka, like even on the website, is it's so linked to hospitality beyond food, sort of hospitality and the way that, for lack of a better word, Russians eat, which combines drinking and eating.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about that tradition?
Absolutely. So my parents immigrated in 1980. I was born the following year. And there was a short period until 1986 before any family started coming over. But I guess from 88. But from that point on until all through the 90s, it was just an onslaught. It felt like, as a kid, you know, every week that I've learned of and met a new third cousin or an aunt. You know, it's just every week a new family and therefore another celebration. And my parents played host to a lot of that. So there was maybe a higher concentration of that than is normal. But still, like, you could sense that this was something that they carried over from before, like that there was just a conversation that had paused. And then once everybody showed back up and joined back together in, you know, in the new country, that they just push play again and continued on. So this sort of like the huge family party every weekend, table full of food and toasting and just going on for hours and hours into the, you know, early morning. That whole thing is just part of what they do, and I loved it so much. And I didn't realize until I was an adult that that's not normal, that that doesn't happen in every household all the time. And I missed it. I missed it, and forming this restaurant, a big part of it was that we really wanted as best as we could in a restaurant environment, because it really isn't quite the same, to try to give that same feel.
What's really incredible about your book is that you start with a chapter on drinking.
Yeah.
And then you move from drinking to pickles, which is perfect because those of us who probably don't know much about Russian food or how it's presented know about vodka and they know about zakuski.
Yeah. It's interesting. People keep pointing that out to me. And it just felt so natural. Like, this is the order in which you have to do things. You know, drinking does not go without eating in Russia. I mean, there are cocktail bars now in Russia, for example. It's all, you know, all the rage. But, you know, the very traditional style of drinking involves heavy eating. You don't just stand around with a cocktail. That's how you get wasted. You know, nobody wants that. So pickles obviously go hand in hand because it's basically the simplest form of zakuska. I should say zakuski or zakuska, which is the singulars, literally means to bite after. And so the thing you're biting after can often is vodka. So just the simplest form of just having some pickles and some vodka sort of sets that up.
So here in Southern California, and particularly in Los Angeles, we're lucky we have a huge Russian community here. So there are a lot of stores. But I think a lot of us are still intimidated about going into those stores and making choices. Can you sort of give us a pep talk about what we can find on the shelves and then how we can present them at the table?
Sure. Absolutely. The first part of this pep talk is you will see scowling faces. Don't worry. Just breathe through it. I think that my dad says that Russians think that if you're smiling for no reason, that you're insane. So anyway, it's kind of funny, but there's also a little bit of truth to it. So yeah, people tend to like be very serious looking and scowl. So just kind of ignore that part of it. But as far as the actual food goes, my favorite places to quickly add flavor are the preserved vegetables. I don't mean like pickles. I mean like various spreads and jarred salads. That's a really great stop. There's something called Ivar, which is really popular. It's like a sort of a pepper spread. And then there's like these various forms of eggplant salad that there's a few different brands and you just kind of can pick what you think looks the most appetizing, but they're full of flavor and delicious and natural and a really quick way to add flavor. The cured meats, you can basically close your eye and just like randomly point at one and I'm sure it will be delicious. Obviously, with more times in there, you could figure out what you like or don't like more or less, but just the sheer assortment of different salamis and various cured meats is just amazing. And then the canned fish, so specifically Sprotts are like my go-to and I think are a great starter fish for people who are unfamiliar. They're little tiny oily smoked fish and they don't have as strong of a flavor as you might expect for something so small as a fish. I think so you think anchovies, which are intensely salty and intensely fishy, and these are not anything like that.
Okay, so now let's talk about soup and its place in sort of the panoply of everyday eating.
I think that soup is, you could just look at different Russian soups and really understand the cuisine just from that. There's such a wide range. Everything from super refreshing, cold, you know, creamy soups, like where you sorrel that gets cooked and then whisked in with sour cream as a chilled soup. Everything from something like that, which, I mean, it has this like almost like Gatorade to me in some ways. It's thirst quenching. Everything from that to the sort of like doldrums of winter, super hearty borscht that's, you know, like meaty and beady and just fills all of the cracks in on the coldest days, and everything in between. I'm sure that other cuisines have similarities, but to me, when I think about Russian food, it's the soups that really excite me.
One of the zakuski that you have features chanterelles.
Oh, that's delicious this time of year.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have some salt-cured chanterelles. That's one of my favorite things to do with chanterelles, actually. So simple. It's just salt and chanterelles and thyme, and they really transform. Chanterelles are such a delicate flavor, you know, compared to some of the more heady mushrooms out there, and this really concentrates their flavors in a lovely way. And I think them with just a little bit of sour cream or smetana, which is the Russian sour cream that we make, and some chives is just like such a lovely little bite, especially with some vodka.
That's Bonnie Fromkin-Morales on Portland-based Russian restaurant Kachka. There's now a cookbook to make her recipes at home. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Of course, you can download our show wherever you get your podcasts, like Spotify. Thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.